So what I wanted to do today is present an alternative model for eukaryotic chemotaxis from what you have heard so far, or what has been in the literature. So this model is based on local stochastic signaling, and I first want to kind of go a little bit into the background and then explain some of the theoretical background on the model and then present some experiments. So the theory part will be relatively short, but I think for most people here this shouldn't be a big deal because it's a very simple theory. And the work is done mostly by a postdoctoral fellow in the lab, Cecil Aryamurlu, and some of the later calculations have been done by On Brandman, who is here in the audience and can tell you more about some of the things he has been doing, which I will not be talking much about. And this was done at Stanford University. So one of the things that I want to emphasize in this presentation is that cell migration and chemotaxis are two very different pairs of shoes. So I want to kind of argue that one has to look at that different. So there's a very clearly defined machinery that's involved in cell migration. It involves lamellipod extension at the leading edge of cells and involves proteins like ARP23, cofillin, RAC, to some degree possibly CDC42 and others. And what these proteins are doing is basically they kind of shear probably at the leading edge actin fibers into smaller pieces, and then from these smaller pieces there will be new actin bundles growing, and that leads to the extension of the lamellipod.
Sorry, can I interrupt at once?
Yeah.
Is there any evidence that it is actually the polymerization of actin that causes lamellipod extension? Because I don't believe it.
Yeah, so I actually should say this is a widely believed hypothesis.
For which the evidence is very poor.
So given the nature of my talk, I think we should probably, because it is not fundamental to what I want to say, okay. So I want to give this as a little introduction more to argue for the separation of the two than for the specifics of it. So the other things involved, and I will also not talk about that if somebody has an issue with this, is that there is continued integrin-based adhesion at the front of cells and release at the back of cells that are part of this. So this is kind of the cytoskeletal machinery for chemotaxis that's needed for cell migration, and there's many systems that show migration at basal uniform concentrations of agonists, and there's no chemotaxis needed for that. That's random migration, and I will go a bit more into that later. Some of the protein players is, and I'm actually showing a recent review, I think that's by Henry Bourne's group here, is mostly shown for that we don't know very well yet in mammalian cells which players are actually involved. There is many different players that have been proposed, including phospholipases, like the A2, the phospholipase C. Then one of the most interesting enzymes, and what I will be talking about a lot, is this PI3 kinase, and there is evidence for feedbacks that might involve GEFs and positive feedbacks in the system, and I will mention that a little bit later, even though it's actually not at the heart of my talk, but I think it's important to maybe in the discussion to go about possible mechanisms of what I will be presenting. So one of the, again, widely believed hypotheses in chemotactic signaling is that there is a chemotactic signaling machinery that involves PIP3 signals, those small GTPases, and the actin cytoskeleton. So this kind of box here somehow leads to the extension of lamellipods, and this spatial sensing is somehow coupling into that system. But as I mentioned before, some of this is also required for just basal migration and is not necessarily related to chemotaxis. So PIP3, as I will kind of try to emphasize, has, in my view, a fundamental role in many cell types in establishing and maintaining cell polarity, which is not something that is necessarily related to chemotaxis again. So just at the player, so you have interestingly two different systems that can couple to this PIP3 and lamellipod extension pathways. It can start with tyrosine receptor activations, like in a system I will be showing data on in fibroblasts, where the platelet-derived growth factor is involved. And also there is a GPCR signal, and the basic machinery is for tyrosine kinase receptors, they signal to two different isoforms of PI3 kinase and then activate the conversion of PIP2 to PIP3. And the same thing will be done by the GPCRs, which involve PI3 kinase gamma. So a lot of my data will focus on this initial step afterwards, arguing about some of the local unit of chemotaxis. So I just wanted to put this up here. So the evidence for the role of PIP3 in chemotaxis goes back about 5 years or so, where some of the initial studies by Devrioli showed that this crack GFP pH domain is accumulating at the leading edge. Initially, I think they believed it binds to the beta gamma subunit of the G proteins, but later, and I think also with some key contributions from Rick Fertel, from Fertel's group, who showed that the cell polarity really is based on a polarity in PI3 kinase signaling. And, oh, sorry, it's the phosphatidylinositol with 3-phosphate lipids on it. And it's generated by an enzyme that acts on another phospholipid and just adds a phosphate on top. And that lipid is polarized in cells, in these dictyostelium cells, or it's also polarized from some studies here, initial study in Henry Born's lab in neutrophils. And we published also at a similar time using a evanescent wave total internal reflection microscopy, where we just look at the gradient of lipid in the adhesion membrane, where a lot of the important events happen for migration. And also in this fibroblast system, we see gradients of PIP3 if we apply a far away bolus of PDGF. So there are these gradients of PIP3 in cells, and they are required for migration as well as for chemotaxis, and I think that's where some of the confusion is coming from. So one of the observations is that even if you have quite a shallow gradient of external chemoattractant, you can get a steeper gradient in 3' PI, and this steepening might be a factor of 2 to 4, or so depending on the system. So there's some kind of a sharpening of the external chemoattractant happening in cells. It's actually not totally clear whether this is truly bistable or not, but that we can talk about later.
In your experiments, you applied a bolus, and you got a stable polarization at the end that first saw the bolus. Is that?
Yeah, it lasts it's a transient thing that lasts for maybe 10 minutes or so, and then it will fade away. In that system.
Is that true of other cell types as well, that if you apply a bolus, it is enough to create a stable polarization at the front end, or is that specific to fibroblasts?
I think that's in most, in all systems where people have looked at that. Typically that's done with a pipette that people kind of put at different places.
So you don't need to maintain a stable gradient to maintain a stable polarization inside the cell. It suffices to apply a bolus.
No, it has to be present in some kind of a gradient format, not everywhere. So this is added locally at an end. So.
In both the neutrophils and in the T cells that don't have adenyl cyclase, if you put them in a uniform chemoattractant, they'll initially just give a general response around the whole cell, but then they'll put out a single pseudopod.
Yeah, that's the same in fibroblasts, actually. Yeah.
They will put out.
But that's the same in fibroblasts.
Right.
So that's in all. So there's, it's kind of an intrinsic cell polarity. So that's actually part of the argument I want to go into, that there's this intrinsic capability to self-polarize for cells. So a lot of the actually theory behind chemotaxis is going back to some of the kind of morphogenic gradients, where people thought about local positive feedbacks combined with long-range negative feedbacks, going back to as far back as Turing and Meinhard and others. And especially Meinhard had more recently than a theoretical paper arguing that stable gradients can be created by such positive negative feedback combinations. So there's also a lot of information. We have another oscillating bistable system in cells, which is the calcium oscillation system. And I want to mention that a little bit, because I think we can learn something about the complexity about how some of these systems are set up in cells. So the Colchian oscillation system is probably the best kind of experimentally addressable bistable system, because there's very good Colchian indicators and you can kind of measure what's happening to things and a lot of perturbation strategies. And what happens is when you add hormones to cells, they often show these kind of oscillations that might have a periodicity of 30 seconds to a few minutes, and each of these calcium spikes or pulses lasts for about 10 or 20 seconds. And there's positive feedback in that system, and it's triggered by a receptor activation of phospholipase C, the production of a second messenger, inositol trisphosphate, which activates IP3 and releases calcium. And now there's interesting two feedbacks in that system. One of them goes from calcium back on the IP3 receptor, and it's very rapid and local, milliseconds, and acts locally in cells. And there's a slower one that takes about a second, by which calcium activates phospholipase C and can produce more IP3. And we believe that this is part of the complexity and the way how the signaling in cells is really organized, is kind of utilizing these two time constants. And this is a bit better suited for spreading the signal. So for example, in cell-to-cell communication where you want to propagate waves, you can use that feedback a bit better than the local one. And the local one, in some cases, you can maintain and keep the system local. This is actually a simplification. There's actually two positive feedbacks. There's also a Rhinandrin receptor, and there's a third positive feedback in that system. And this gives you an idea of how we think maybe the chemotactic system is built, that it's actually probably not made from single individual feedbacks. It becomes even more complicated when you look at the negative feedbacks. We at least know five negative feedbacks in that system that help bring the calcium signal down. So there's not a single negative feedback, so you have multiple positive feedbacks and negative feedbacks that are important in different systems. And if you perturb that, you get alterations in these oscillation patterns. But still, so you can use models like that and kind of distill out key elements and try to find out what are some of the fundamental important parameters. And my argument is that one can actually dissect the chemotactic problems into different sub-problems and solve them separately. And I don't want to talk much about that, but you know, you can also kind of look at which parameter spaces where you get propagating waves and oscillations versus stable gradients. And some of the strongest argument for this directed movement comes from experiments where people have used cell-permeable PIP3, and there's several groups that have done that now, that are added to cells, and cells then will trigger some kind of autopolarization and drive out the lamellipod in one direction. So the idea is that somehow downstream from PIP3, there is a capability of self-polarize the cell. So if you activate that signaling step, or if you activate a receptor, each cell is capable of setting up a polarity. So it doesn't need any kind of gradient or anything like that. A uniform application of an agonist will create a polarized cell that can migrate in one direction. So one of these hypotheses is that positive feedback for directional sensing is created by a local positive feedback at the leading edge, which then leads to the setup of this gradient with this fast or long-ranging negative feedback that kind of suppresses the back of the cell. And actually, it's not totally clear to me from looking at a lot of PIP3 traces whether this is really a fundamental property of cells. I think there is a fundamental property in most cells, which is to self-polarize and migrate in one direction. It's the data on actually bistability in the PIP3 system is a bit less clear. So the main problem with this model that has been put forth by most people in the chemotaxis field is doesn't really explain you how actually cells migrate. When you look at migration of cells, they show kind of something like a biased random walk. And most of these models, when you actually calculate them through, they're not really suited to describe that kind of a biased random walk phenomenon.
What do you mean by that?
So I will show some of the data and how that looks like. So what I think some of that will be clear from kind of trying to put the elements together for people here. So So I think if we think about chemotaxis, we have to separate it into two processes. One of them is the capability of most cells to randomly migrate, which requires cell polarization and unipolar actin-based lamellipodia extension at the leading edge. And then you have chemotaxis, which runs on top of this, which is a higher order cellular mechanism that functions on top of this basic migration pathway and allows the spatial sensing. So, and I think so, a lot of my arguments will build on this, dividing the problem into these two sub-problems. So when people actually look at stable gradient, we haven't seen that yet in this meeting, so I want to present some of the experimental strategies that have been used for that. There's this thing called the Dunn chamber, but it has also a few other names, which basically allow you to create a gradient from an outer well to an inner well that's about over a millimeter, and you can get pretty nice. This is actually a measurement of a gradient in this region here. The cells are here grown upside down on a cover slate put on top, and by adding the chemoattractant on the outside and having on the inside no chemoattractant, you can set up these stable long-term gradients for hours. And now you can go in and monitor what these cells are doing in that gradient over time. And when you do that, and this is taking data from Henry Bourne's group, you see that you have effectively something that resembles a biased random walk. And each of these traces is a different cell who has been put at this origin by, it's a software tracking basically, and then we kind of show here what the cell is doing. This is a neutrophil in a C5A chemotactic gradient. So at any given time, these cells actually don't necessarily go towards the source. They might actually go away from it. It's just that overall, on average, they tend to go towards the source. And any model of chemotaxis has to explain this, and I'm showing you a simple model that explains all this data very easily. So there's some reasons to separate this chemotaxis from random migration based also on biochemistry. There's studies by Anne Ridley and others that show that you can disrupt some signaling proteins without affecting the speed in random migrations. You have the same gradient applied. These cells will randomly migrate in any direction, but they lost their capacity to sense the gradient. So you can separate, again, random migration from directed migration.
What cell is that?
This is done in a macrophage. Yeah,
and the cells are polarized.
Still polarized, they have the same lamellipods at the front, everything looks the same.
So cells are polarized irrespective of whether they're chemotaxing or not.
Yeah, so, and I think this is true in most cell types, and there's also other arguments for that, which, for example, here in fibroblasts, an example, where if you apply a uniform PDGF where you have the thing on both sides of the thing, you get this random migration. The velocity and any of the properties are indistinguishable from the chemotaxis case. Only here you have kind of a bias in your random migration. So I think this is kind of the basis now for this idea that I want to present here. So what happens now when we actually look at cells is that they have a leading edge here, and this activity at the leading edge is not even. So you have occasionally things happening where the lamellipod extension will be biased to the left, and you get a little turn, minus delta 2 here. And then the next time it might be biased to the right, and it wiggles back to the right. And this is basically the idea here, is that each extension of a lamellipod puts a little directional pull on it. And this is now where some of this oscillating and other activity is coming in. So each pushing out of a lamellipod makes a small directional change in where the cell is going. So when we actually look at some fibroblasts that are migrating, and we analyze now the leading edge every 20 seconds here, we see that often these extensions might happen primarily on the left and on the right, maybe in a few different places. It kind of looks like stochastic events where lamellipod extensions are driven in different directions. So, and everybody is familiar with how you can now use stochastic arguments. So we look, for example, here now, what happens on the left side, on the middle, and on the right, and look whether the events there are correlated. So we look now at how much extension we get on the left, in the middle, and on the right. And when you look at some of these points here, there doesn't seem to be a significant correlation between what's happening on the left of the cell from the right of the cell. So lamellipod extension is not something that has a front-back kind of logics here, it has a left-right logics at the leading edge. So assuming this, we can then do a simple correlation analysis where we put a leading edge boundary here, and we calculate the correlation from left to right. And you see here that you get about over 2 micron, which this whole thing is maybe about 20 micron correlation for these lamellipods, which basically says the kind of logical unit, the size of these lamellipod extension is maybe about 20% of the entire leading edge. So the pushing out is pretty small. So now the hypothesis that we developed into a simple model is that the chemoattractant binding to a receptor activates local signaling, which in turn increases the probability that a local amyloid extension occurs. So that we basically say there's now a local link where the sampling of the chemoattractant at this leading edge is coupled to, by a probability term, to how likely it is that this amyloid gets triggered out. So you make it a bit more likely to push this out if you have a receptor that ligates there. So this basically assumes that even though there is receptors and signaling all over the cell, the signaling that's actually relevant for chemotaxis is only at the front of the cell. Yeah?
That was a time correlation diagram that you took.
Sorry?
That was a time correlation diagram.
No, it was spatial correlation. So that's good. So this is spatial correlation. So basically it says the size here is about 20% of this thing. This is averaging hundreds of images up. Yeah. Yes, sir? You mean time cross correlation at the same place? Oh, so here this is shown over time. So here it is plotted at. That's not a correlation. Yeah. No, there's no. I mean, maybe if you go with some Fourier transform in, you find some frequency because there is a certain time constant to the extension of these lamellipods. But I don't think there is an oscillatory in these. Oh, yeah. What time parameter? Yeah, I will talk about time parameters a bit later when we talk about signaling in this system. So this is basically now this our model for stochastic signaling model for eukaryotic chemotaxis, which basically says that what really is important for chemotaxis is what's happening at the leading edge. So these local receptor inputs here sample the chemoattractant and they link and increase the probability that at that site where the receptor was ligated, there will be a lamellipod extension. I will show you afterwards some evidence for that. So this will lead here to a left turn, this will lead to a right turn. And each of these local spots now is linked to a directional change delta. And there will be a very simple equation for chemotaxis originating from that we think can describe chemotaxis in all cell types. So you can now take an angle here towards chemotaxis. So at any given time, this chemotaxin cell has a certain orientation towards the source, or where the source is of the gradient. And you can introduce this delta C over C term that basically says how much of a gradient does this leading edge of the cell really see. So what is the maximal concentration difference of chemoattractant up here in this region versus this region? So it will turn out that this is the only two parameters that are important for directional sensing. You need to know nothing else. No velocity thing, no frequency of these events, and nothing like that. So could you first do the kind of Monte Carlo modeling of this? You have leading edge local events, so if you have more events here, you get pushed to the right and you create this biased random walk from that. And you see that here in a little simulation where each of these, so what is basically just modeled here, that each of these little spots will push out the lamellipod, and then the lamellipod will lead to a small directional change. And if you follow different cells, you can now get ideas about what are the directional changes that happen in that. And here we have made a certain assumption that this is a 2.5% kind of gradient across the leading edge. So we'll just analyze a bunch of these traces, and depending on how much of a gradient we apply here, you get then traces that are kind of biased towards the source or that are persistently going towards the source depending on how steep the gradient is. So this is actually a very nice description of experimentally observed migration paths based on the simple assumption that you have stochastic lamellipod extensions at the leading edge.
How big a gradient did you have?
2%.
2% over the whole cell?
Over the leading edge of the cell, yeah.
So how big is that over the whole cell?
Yeah, so in these cells, the leading edge is actually similar. It's a wider front. Maybe it's half the cell length or so.
So in the absence of the gradient, it would be an
Yeah, that's what basically what you see here. If you have a uniform stimulus, then you just get this random path. So the velocity and everything looks the same. It's just not biased
what
towards the source.
The asymmetry.
So that's what I'm arguing, that these cells and all, at least the kind of mammalian cells and probably also the dictyostelium have an inherent capacity or an inherent need to self-polarize. And that
you
might
address.
So I will not address that, but I can give my comments on that at the end. But I want to separate the kind of chemotaxis model that I want to develop here from that. Yeah.
Two related questions. So there is some without chemotaxis, there is some probability for unit time to get to the null pod at any point on the circumference.
So the problem is with the mammalian cells, at least, you know, so if you have them in serum, most of the serum components actually function as kind of a uniform chemoattractant background, and most cells migrate in the presence of their normal serum in culture. So if you apply now this PDGF gradient, that this either on top of the serum that's present, or you can do it in the absence of it, and PDGF can on its own act as everything that's needed for the basal migration, or you could use the serum to do that and you don't need the PDGF in that system. And I think that's the same for most cells like macrophages and, yeah.
So, I guess the question is, you know, I guess the horse before the cart, I think. I mean, if the cells are in a gradient, in a sufficient gradient in order to polarize,
but if you had a uniform gradient, they all polarize. Do you agree with
me? No. Wait. We all talk about uniform. I mean, it's a terrible term, but we all talk about uniform gradients. If you're putting them in a gradient, 2% gradient, they theoretically, according to data, they probably do not polarize. But in a 6% gradient, they will polarize.
No. Okay. So I have to make this clear. This is then not clear. So all cells that we know of and we have ever seen studied by anybody, in a uniform exposure to a chemoattractant, they self-polarize. So I think this is something that a lot of theoreticians might not be aware of. Yeah.
Dictyostelium doesn't maintain it for the period of time that I think you're looking at here. Those cells in a uniform chemoattractant are taking a direction and maintaining it for an hour or two, right?
No. These turn. They constantly turn.
But not much.
No. This is just the time scale you put on this thing.
Right.
This is just the turn.
How long has that cell been traced?
So I think we should probably continue because I have actually some of the model data that shows the equations and we will become more clear what the equations are from the quantitation of the data. And I think especially the theoreticians will probably appreciate that. So what actually happens now when you have this migration is that the key question really is for chemotaxis is not necessarily what is happening overall and kind of tracking this thing, but the question is what is the probability at a given time for a cell to migrate in a particular direction? And our goal was to derive the equation for that. And this is what I want to really get to before we get hooked on the details, which we can address, I think. Okay, so the unexpected finding for this is that we came up with this general equation for chemotaxis that argues that there's only two parameters that matter for chemotaxis. This again separating this polarity issue. So we are saying that the key thing for chemotaxis is that each local signaling event couples to a local probability an increase in local probability that the Lamilla pod gets extended at this point. And that's linked to an average angular step size or turn angle. And the only thing relevant to understand the directional characteristics of any chemotactic cell are these two parameters. What is the relative steepness of the chemotractant gradient, and what is this angular step size? So there's no other parameter that's needed to predict the orientation of this. And the equation is very simple, and I think you can probably all calculate that in very short time if you put it down. And I want to go off into more the experimental verification of this model after that. So the equation is very simple. It's just that you have this e to the g over delta times cosinus alpha, and we call this chemotactic ratio, and it's basically just g over delta, which describes how biased and how much towards the source chemotaxis will be. And this gamma is just a normalization constant to get a probability of 1. So we argue that this is describing it. And just to now look about how this is plotted, so you basically can look now over the angle of migrations, so how often it goes towards the chemotractant source and how often it goes away from it. So it's less probable that it goes away from the source, it's more probable that it goes towards it, and this is this migration angle alpha it runs into. And we can either now analyze our Monte Carlo simulations and get in these plots, we can convert this over into this thing, and you can fit that with these polarity constants. So depending on what you choose here for the g over delta, you get either random migration, which means that the g over delta is close to zero, which means basically you have a circular probability field, and you get random migration in a uniform condition. You get biased random walk if this thing is around one, where kind of most of the time it goes towards it or against it. Yeah. So this is a consequence of just the idea that you have an angular step size per local signaling event. So that goes into that.
Yeah. I understand what the angular step size means.
So
it has units of length.
No, it has a unit of an angle of radian.
Wait, then I don't understand how g is a gradient. So this is g.
G is a relative gradient. It's delta c over c. G is delta C over C. It's 2% or 4% difference in.
It's the difference, not the grade. It's the.
So those are all unitless parameters. These are all unitless parameters. So it's. So it's delta.
Times the size of a.
No, it's not logarithm. It's delta C over C.
Well,
yeah.
Over the diameter of the cell.
Over the leading edge. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's actually one. It becomes one parameter. Yeah, but yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a ratio. Yeah, it's a ratio. Yeah, it's one parameter. Sorry. Yeah, yeah. So that's. I'm coming to that. So time is not relevant for the directional probability, in that. It gives you the probability that at a given time, it's directed towards or away from the source. Yes, sir.
Yeah. No. Can I just be sure I understand? So, in the language of theory, this is a postulate. You don't derive this equation from anything. What you're proposing is that a good in my language, what you're proposing is that a phenomenological description of the chemotactic data can be obtained by postulating that cells move their lamellar podia with this distribution.
You can derive that from a difference. You can derive it from a difference equation with some simple assumptions. The equation. We can go through that.
Okay. Derive it from a difference equation.
With an assumption about that some of the parameters are small. Yeah.
Okay. So.
So the assumption of the models are that there is that each local signaling event leads to a delta. turn.
Okay.
And so the assumption is that there are local signaling events that lead to local turns. And the second assumption is that there is a gradient that's, and the relative gradient is important for the probability difference for left to right. So that the probability difference to hit the left or the right of the front of the cell is proportionate to this delta C over C. So those are the two assumptions in there. And then the other thing you can derive, this equation.
Okay, so there's an underlying postulate.
Yeah, the postulate is, I think the fundamental postulate that probably some people might disagree with is that there is a local link from a receptor stimulus to lamellipod extension. And I want to show you some data that this is the case in these fibroblasts. Yeah.
Maybe just one clarification point about time issue. The time is going to depend upon the biological system, and it's going to be intrinsic for that biological system. So your cell, fibroblast, is going to have one time constant. Kidney cells are going to have another time constant, but it's not pertinent to understanding the directionality.
Yeah, so they might run at a different speed, and also the...
Or the signaling pathway will run at a different, will run with different kinetics.
So yeah, yeah, response. Yeah. There could be a wide range of time. I mean, the dicti are much faster than these fibroblasts are very slow compared to the dicti. So the time scale is 100 times compressed.
More capable.
They're better cells. Yeah.
Still hung up on the importance of having delta as a parameter. If I understand you correctly, at this stage you're just asking, what is the angular distribution of these local polarization events which lead
to... No. This is the angular... Oh, sorry, then I have to go back. So this is not... Then I wasn't clear. So this is not the angular distribution of the... This is the... This has nothing to do with this local... with the local lamellipods where they're created. This has... This says is what is the orientation of a cell at a given time.
Well, to me, this is basically some integral over the first distribution.
No, that's not true.
Sorry.
The direction of a cell is a, see, this is the experimental thing that you see here. I mean, this is what you measure. So these kind of measurements are directions of the cell at a given time. So we're basically saying that cells have random migration, they have biased random walk, or they have more persistent migration towards the source, and each moment they have a certain orientation that you can measure. You can put an axis through them and say this is.
Is it conceivable to make another measurement? Just ignore the actual motion and look at the distribution of these local.
Instead, this is what we try to do here in this.
Bright spots of.
Yeah, this is what this is. This is difference images. This is actually images, difference images of cells that are binarized and showed.
Just ask. So presumably with uniform chemoattractant. They will be uniformly distributed over the periphery, right, over the circumference. Now,
no, not at the circumference, at the leading edge. They're not uniformly everywhere.
So this is what I'm missing. So there is a leading edge even in the...
Yeah, this is the fundamental thing of this thing. So every cell type that I have ever seen, I want to see data if there's another case like that. But in all macrophages, neutrophils, fibroblasts, when they are in a normal environment, they are polarized. They never exist unpolarized. They always migrate.
They have a head and tail to begin with.
So when you take cells out of an incubator, so any mammalian cells you take out of an incubator, it will move. The next hour it will not be at the same place. They all migrate. Yeah.
But, I mean, in dicti cells at least, my understanding is that you can get highly polarized cells, typically later in development, where, for example, if you try to get it to move in a new direction that's not moving in, the leading edge will turn in the way you described.
But
in earlier stages,
there's the complication is that often this is on the situations where they self-produce ATP. And so the problem is when you go to low density dicti, according to Peter Davriotis, they do the same thing. I could be
Well, it's even, I mean, there's a paper out in Cell 2 weeks ago by Carol Grant who knocked out the adenyl cyclase, and they behave just like neutrophils. They do not initially self-polarize. So this issue of self-polarization is, the Born feedback, I mean, there's some kind of feedback loop that establishes, and it is regulated. And you're right that the more polarized the cells are, the harder it is to get them to turn, but that's only, it only has to do with how much signal input you need in order to disrupt the old cytoskeleton and establish a new one. But these are quantitative effects that are a bit artificial. I mean, I think that Tobias is right, and Dickey's stelian cells will behave exactly the way Tobias said if you take out the autocrine system of it producing its own cyclic AMP. They behave just like Tobias said. So that there's a complication in Dickey cells. At some level, it's intrinsic on the biological properties, what they have to do biologically, but it's not pertinent to the question that Tobias is trying to address. At least I would argue that.
No, my question was maybe simpler than the one you answered. So I was led to believe that maybe this is a specific thing with Dickey, as you say, due to the cyclic AMP signaling, but I've been led to understand that there are, roughly speaking, you can get two different types of behavior. You can get polarized cells, really polarized cells, that have a leading edge or going in some direction, and then if you try to make them go a different way, the typical behavior will be they will take their existing leading edge and they will sort of turn it towards the direction you're going in, as sort of described by this class of models. But then there were other cells which are less polarized, more naive cells, that would respond to a stimulus to go in a different direction by completely pulling back in the leading edge and sending out a new pseudopod in a new direction.
Yeah, so
and that could not be treated by just saying the leading edge is turning.
A polarized cell, a highly polarized cell, and a more naive cell, as you put it, can produce the same behavior. It just depends upon how strong the signal.
I understand, but this type of model seems to be relevant for a polarized cell, not for a naive cell.
So maybe,
in that light, is that fair?
So, but maybe we should then focus on polarized cells here and then argue afterwards how the non-polarized cells work. And I want to understand where they are. I mean, I want to see this non-polarized cells.
Any cell that's moving is polarized.
And
it's a question of persistence. I mean, I was about to say the same thing. I mean, polarized means, of course, any cell that's moving, it's moving, so therefore it's polarized. But the question is, what happens when it changes direction? Does it change direction by turning and keeping the same actin cytoskeletal leading edge and just reorienting it slightly, or does it move by pulling itself in completely and then just constructing a new pseudopod and moving in a totally different direction?
So I think in some circumstances you can come with a pipette and force it in a new direction, but it's happening relatively rarely that you have a breakdown of cell polarity, but I think it happens in cells. So I'm not excluding that. So let's say that this model applies for all cases where there's no breakdown in cell polarity. Maybe this is a...
So is the answer basically that it's a matter of signal strength?
I would even argue, honestly, when polarity is going to depend upon the signal strength. So that you have a cell, and the highly polarized cell that Herbie's talking about have very, very strong accumulations, cytoskeletal accumulations on the two ends, and they're almost fairly rigid. I mean, it's basically like dealing with a polarized brick house. But if you have a strong enough signal that comes in, you can disrupt that because the receptors
are everywhere there.
Signal everywhere. It just depends upon the strength of that signal as to whether you get a cell that turns or whether you get a cell that disrupts the original polarity. And the naive cells, just all it means is it takes less of the signal to do that disruption.
Okay.
But it's still the same principle.
Okay, so now given, and so this is now where I think some of the complication is coming in. As we saw before, that PIP3 has this global front-to-back role, and I think this is important in many cells for maintaining and maybe even establishing cell polarity. So PIP3 has this kind of global role in cells, and I want to now argue that maybe PIP3 has on top of that a local role in controlling local lamellipod extension. So the way how we measure that is with these GFP, PH, AKT domains, and you have seen some of that, but I want to kind of go a little bit into that, because if you talk about local signaling, and I want to also talk about some artifacts that happen with these probes. So this is when we initially made these probes, and he looked at some PAF cells as an example, and you stimulate them and it goes to the plasma membrane in cells. You can use that as a kind of a ID for how much PIP3 lipids are there at the plasma membrane. So what this probe actually is doing is when you look at this in a model here, this is about a real-time speed of diffusion in cells, and many people are not aware of how fast actually proteins diffuse in cells. So when you actually look with diffusion measurements how quickly things move around in the cytosol, this is about how much they would do, and they hit maybe the plasma membrane, you know, 5 times per second or so, quite often. So now if a PIP3 molecule is there, it can stabilize the probe, and what you see, the static picture, is actually a kind of very dynamic thing. So every 200 milliseconds, this pH domain will actually come off the plasma membrane and go back on. So it's not a real static situation, and that's why these probes can be used to measure things very rapidly and to measure things also locally, as I want to argue now. So in these fibroblasts, you can show that the PDGF-induced chemotaxis, it's basically a wound healing response. So these cells, they want to, not very rapidly, but they want to get to the wound and kind of fill it in and heal it. And PDGF is used as a chemoattractant for that. And so we showed before that there's this gradient there, and this just shows that when you block this enzyme, you lose at the same time this lamellipod extension, as you lose also the ability to chemotax. I don't want to go into these assays, but basically in these cells, both the ability to migrate as well as the ability to chemotax are dependent on the same enzyme, and it makes it a little bit more complicated in what I want to argue here. So I think the PIP3 is really required for a front-to-back cell polarity, but it has an additional second function which is related to local signaling and local lamellipod extension. So I want to now show you some data where we characterized where these PIP3 signals really are in migrating cells. And this just shows some migration data here where this fibroblast is in a chemoattractant gradient, and you see now these flashes here of pH domain at the top, which you wouldn't see if you just have a control domain. So now the problem with that is that we were immediately concerned that actually what we are seeing here is not really local pH domains, but actually what we really might be seeing is just membranes that are accumulated. The way how these cells and many other cells migrate is they kind of crawl forward, and if you kind of condense membranes together, you could just get more membranes, and if you have some uniform membrane binding, it just looks like more pH domain. So what can you do about that? So there's actually an easy way to calibrate that, and this shows how we're going about that. So we're using two colors of GFP, a YFP pH domain, and then a plasma membrane marker that most people believe is very uniform in the plasma membrane. So it's the end of KRAS, which has a polybasic region and a farnesylation site, for those who know that a bit. But it's basically just a marker of the plasma membrane. And now we can take these two and just ratio by them each other. And now the interesting thing is some of these actually hot flashes that we saw are falling out, while others remain. And these are kind of at the top of the cell near the edge there. And so you have these local pulses that we see at the leading edge of cells. Yeah?
What's
the
imaging technique?
So this is this here is confocal imaging.
How big
is the so this is probably corresponding. So this is taken with a NIPCow, so we actually can't use confocal for that, I should say. The cells don't migrate in confocal microscopy. So it's this NIPCow confocal disc, so it corresponds to a thickness. So it's not really, you know, confocal with one pinhole. Okay. It's with several thousand little micro lenses where you focus it back through the holes. So that gives you a thicker C section, but still some section capability in the system. So So one of the concerns here that, you know, sometimes these membrane enrichments reflect more membrane and not local signals, but you can calibrate it and actually measure where are these local signals. And you see when you have controls where you just take CACs in both channels, you wouldn't see these, but you see them when you ratio the pH domain over something else. And now we can analyze how often these are triggered and where they are triggered and try to relate them to these lamellipod extensions. And this just shows images when we take like tracking cells over time, then these are pretty small. These are on the scale of, as you will see, of about 2 microns diameter, these hot flashes. They seem to be on the top of the cell and near the edge of it. We don't see very much, at least we haven't looked as detailed at the surface, but we have so far not seen them there. So they seem to be on the top of the cell.
I'm sorry, so did that really help using CFP CACs? I mean,
Yeah, we otherwise would have thought that about 2/3 of the local signals were really more membrane. Yeah.
I just want to make that myself clear right now. So this is, these local filters are on top of the already existing gradient in PIP3,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. These are local enrichments of PIP3. The question is, what is the result of having that there?
Can you say anything about the quantity? I mean, how steep is the gradient of the PIP3 status there?
So we name something a pulse if it's more than 50% of what's there on top of what is there. So that's our threshold for that we use then for the analysis of lamellipod extension.
Do you see correlation between these spores and the lamellipod?
Yeah, I will come to that. Yeah. So the size of these is pretty small. This is what's confocal, yeah. Yeah, so far the only other, so these pH domains bind to lipid membranes.
So you could form some, you have this kind of distinct spot in the,
yeah, but so you think it could be something else then?
No, I think maybe not on membrane. Because you're not really measuring PIP3, you're measuring pH domain.
Enrichment, yeah. But you know, so we wouldn't know of other structures they could bind to, and it doesn't look like vesicles from the kinetics and from, so you know, we know how vesicles look like in these cells. Yeah.
These curious, I mean, these lines that you see could come in the physical
outputs. Sorry.
They could come these lines that you, these extra lines that you see. You know, that's why you make a comparison. Right?
Yeah. So it's basically, there's also a lot of membrane enrichments.
So they could come just like your physical outputs.
No, this is, it's fluorescence imaging.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. You can get diffraction. I talked to you about.
Yeah.
But the comparison technique gets rid of that also.
Pardon me?
Wasn't your comparison? Wasn't the comparison?
No, the comparison technique is one of them.
It gets rid of the optic effect.
Yeah.
Okay, so the duration of these pulses is on average about 40 seconds. And
do you know what? Do you have any imaging in the same period of what the cytoskeleton is doing? If there's if those spots are also, you know, I don't know, places of high RP2/3 concentration or something. In other words,
yeah. So we haven't gone. So we have now looked at the relationship between these pulses and the extension of lamellipods. That's what I just can show. We don't have data like that. So if we have now local, so these local pulses of PIP3 that you see here. Then in many cases we see afterwards a lamellipod extension at or near this site. It's not at the same place necessarily as you see here. So we're actually not sure yet what the physical link is. There's also an interesting delay between these PIP3 pulses and the extension, as you see here. So in almost all cases when we see a PIP3 pulse like that, about 40 seconds later there is a lamellipod extension. So the question is, in the control places there wouldn't be an extension, so they are preceding the extension and there's a lag, so 20 seconds later we don't see yet very much and 40 seconds later there. So there is a delay time or a feedback loop or whatever you want to call that between this PIP3 pulses and what's happening. So the machinery is complicated, that involves probably some kind of ARP2/3 and other things, but we don't know about that. And then we have just tried to make some rough estimates about what the turn angle is in these, and I can talk about that a bit more if people are interested in that. And we think it's about, corresponds to maybe about 4 degrees of turn per PIP3 pulse. And you know, we get fairly good mapping of some of the migration data of this biased random walks we see onto this function and our polarity analysis. So we think there's a lot of points that I haven't gotten into. There is occasionally probably these reversals that cells do, which lead to, in some degree, to a back thing here. So we haven't included everything that's probably going on in that system. But what we have is, I think, a very basic and simple formalism that allows one to understand the question of directionality in chemotaxis. And I think models before have not really been able to address that. And So basically we propose here that this chemotaxis is based on a localized chemotaxis unit that's at the leading edge of the cell, and it links local receptor signals to local extension of lamellipodia. And this is based on the fundamental assumption that cell polarity might be set up in different ways in different cells, and it's really something different than spatial sensing. And we propose a stochastic signaling model for chemotaxis that is basically predicting that chemotactic system, that you can predict their directionality and with which direction they go at a given time with this one constant, with this one ratio, G over delta, which is basically the step size, how much of a turn you get per local signaling event and how much of a relative gradient you have at the front. And I think we have several evidences that suggest that this model might be correct, that we demonstrated that lamellipod extension is a stochastic process, at least in these fibroblasts, that PDGF-triggered PIP3 pulses are local, and that these local PIP3 pulses enhance the probability for local lamellipod extension, and that we can get a fairly good match of the equation and simulations to these parameters that we can see from the cell biology. Thank you.
I think one could read your summary as saying that there isn't a different mechanism between cell polarity and chemotaxis, because if you end up, what you're effectively saying is that you enhance the probability. What you're changing is the probability for lamellipod extension in normal migration. So I don't understand why you keep wanting to say the mechanisms for cell polarity and chemotaxis are distinct. I can't understand that.
Oh, so you're...
Did you understand what I mean?
Yeah, I think what Tobias is saying is that the directionality is overlaid on the basic motility machine.
But why are they different? They're not different. Because the second thing here is that the pulse enhances the probability of...
The reason is the inverse is not true. Right. We see lamellipod extension without local PIP3 pulses.
Of course.
Yeah.
So what the PIP3 pulse does is to change the probability, which is exactly what you said.
Yeah.
But to call them totally different mechanisms seems to me...
But you could have in systems... So
on top of each other. No, but they are distinct.
Well, the point is you can have basal without chemotaxis.
You see, our idea is that there is this kind of autocatalytic machinery that makes lamellipodia, which might or might not involve PIP3 in a really regulatory way. It might just be required at some level for things to be happening there. So it's not required as a local increase and decrease as part of the extension process. It just has to be there, maybe. So the argument here is that there is kind of an autocatalytic machinery for lamellipod extension, and somehow these local PIP3 pulses feed into that and just change the probability for this feed.
That's what you said.
Yeah. So that's, at least that best explains our data, I think, yeah.
So there are two, do these PIP3 pulses depend on the cytoskeleton to exist? In other words, let's say you had a mutant, I don't know, CDC42 null, or you had a Latrunkian treatment or something where you got rid of all the cytoskeletal dynamics. So there are two logical possibilities. One logical possibility is the mechanism for creating these PIP3 pulses still exists. Of course, it doesn't do anything now because there's nothing for it to act on. The other possibility is they don't even exist, that feedback from the cytoskeletal thing are necessary to create these PIP3 pulses. Do you have any evidence one way or the other?
We haven't done that experiment, but I can tell you that we see them primarily at the leading edge and not in the back, these local, even though we know we have PDGF receptors and activation. Yeah, but you don't know about local pulses, and I don't think anybody has.
Born has done the trunk line of major
pulses. Yeah, but they haven't been tested in a shallow gradient, or you know. So there's different. You know, you if you apply a pipette near a cell, you can create gradients that might be a bit different than the gradients that are created if you have a functioning cytoskeletal present. You know, nobody has done the comparison in a 2% gradient with a neutrophil, looking how the PIP3 gradient looks like in with and without latranquiline. My guess would be it looks very, very different, but no, but not with a shallow gradient, with a pipette near the. So you know, but you know, if you put a pipette near a cell, I mean, you can calculate the gradient you create from that. I mean, if you come near a cell that's one cell diameter away with a pipette, you're not creating a 2% gradient very easily. At least initially, you have kind of a burst where all of your signal is here. Very little is back. So pipette experiments are a bit difficult to interpret because they're not time stable, you know. So when you initially come, you do something a bit different, and then later, over time, you might get a gradient that's 4-1. It's still, you know, not a few percent. So I think one would have to compare in some kind of a flat chamber, and this hasn't been done. I'm pretty sure of that in neutrophils.
I think the question about self-polarity chemotaxis being distinct or not distinct, I don't think it's resolved, and I'm not arguing one way or the other. I mean, I think it's a really important issue. By trying to look at that, I think you get a better understanding of what the two pathways are. But
I'm not saying it's different pathways. I'm saying that, you know, there's kind of a logic distinction between them mechanistically.
Fine. If you take a naive cell that's not polarized, you put it in a uniform field of chemotraction, it takes a while to start to move. It takes a significant period of time relative to putting them in a gradient to actually start to move forward.
Yeah, but this is a gradient probably started in this way. You know, we don't know how much, if you have a 2% gradient, how quick it would start. I think a 2% gradient looks to a cell maybe very similar than you.
Right, right. It's pushing.
But there's some adaptation issues and others. So if you kind of dump things onto cells, you know, you have this initial kind of getting to some set point adaptation mechanism.
But I guess my question really isn't what's happening if you put them in a uniform field of chemoattractant, is that you have some stochastic pathway that must amplify in order to produce a functional leading edge, a functional polarity within the cell, which then finally allows it to move forward. I'm not sure that.
Yeah, but you're saying that from a transition where you basically deprive the cell of their normal serum, or so. I mean, I'm more familiar with the mammalian system. So the mammalian systems, if you take them out of the incubator, they are polarized. You know, you don't have to add something to polarize them. So the reason why a lot of the cells that you see in the papers are not polarized is people remove all the serum and then they add things back.
But don't you want? I mean, in actuality, when you start to ask the question of what is required, I mean, it'd be nice to have a naive cell.
Yeah.
It'd be nice to have an unpolarized cell to ask what happens when you initially set up a directional movement.
Yeah. Or the argument is also you might want to change gradients and look how there's other ways of manipulating the. But there is the adaptation issue. I mean, all these systems have to adapt to a set point where they function in the right system, and that might take some time at different amounts of time in different systems.
The sensitivity issue that you want to replicate. So here it looks like we can sense arbitrary small gradient as long as delta is sufficiently small.
Yeah, but the reality is there will be, that only works in the adaptive, in the range where the cell is capable to adapt. Of course, then you get the same problem as in bacterial chemotaxis, where you get into the number noise issue. So I don't know about, which concentration unit this thing really works. That depends on the cell. How many receptors are there? How many of them can be desensitized and adjusted to the concentration of chemoattractant that you have? So chemotaxis works over maybe, 1.5 order of magnitude, or maybe factor of 3 or 5. It doesn't work over any range. It's not like vision or something. I mean, there is a limited range over which you get chemotaxis. But you get adaptation and yeah.
And it seems to me that most models you have for the noise, bias between the absolute value of the concentration as well as the relative concentration gradient. I mean, if you're counting more than one binding event, the noise would have been sort of absolute numbers.
So your argument is actually it matters, the C will affect some of the noise properties. Yeah. You're right. I think it's sampling, of course. We're talking about for a migration path like that, many thousand. We should probably move on.
No, go ahead.
You're sampling a few thousand receptor ligation events for that, and at some point you get into number noise. But if you go too high with the concentration, what the cell likely is doing is it just takes receptor out of the system, so it uses a smaller number of receptor.
And maybe one or two more questions, and then we'll, before Pavlov gets
Sir?
So if you bias the probability to the measure of the difference in concentration, how
the cell can measure that? Or? Yeah, it's by stochastic sampling. It's just you have a 2% difference on the left, so you get 2% more turns towards than away. And that gives this distribution. That's coming from that analysis. Yeah, so the frequency of, the absolute concentration doesn't go into this equation. It just gets slower. If you have less sampling moments, your turn time becomes slower.
So the frequency is directly dependent on concentration. It's not that
it's... Yeah, and the frequency is not entering this equation. That's why it's not important what... But the turn rates might go up if you have more hits. But the question is really, we don't know what this hit rate is on the receptor at a given concentration because you have these adaptation processes. So it's not only the number of ligation events, it's the number of events that couple through to the lamellipodia extension. So you don't know how many of the... If you could have desensitization at different points in the pathway. So we don't understand that part. No, I think it's just local at the left, so depending on where it is, it gives more probability for a left and a right turn, but it's not integrating the information in that sense.
Yeah, we better move on.